Over the summer month or so, we've been looking together at a few of the stories that Jesus told. One we were looking at last week as Ben was leading us through it was all about waiting for a great event and the fact that some people who were waiting were prepared for it and some people weren't. The actual story Jesus told had the picture of a wedding and waiting for the bridegroom to arrive. But it was a picture, of course. It was a parable. It had a lesson for us. And the answer to, well, what are we all waiting for is, of course, we are waiting for the day of judgment. We are waiting for Jesus to return. Your initial response might be, well, most people aren't. Most people don't take any thought of whether Jesus is coming back or a day of judgment. But if you stop and think about it, I think many people actually are waiting for that. It comes out every time that someone says, why doesn't somebody do something about the mess the world is in? Or, if there is a God, why doesn't he just step in and sort it out? When people say those sort of things, really what they're saying is, why doesn't God come and judge? There's a feeling in people that they would love to see that the mess the world is in sorted out. And the Bible is absolutely clear about the fact that one day he will. Verse 31 of Matthew 25 says, when the Son of Man comes in all his glory and all the angels with him, he will sit on his throne in heavenly glory, and all the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate the people one from the other. It will happen. The day is coming. So last week we looked at that story when he told to explain that he is coming back. It will be a day of judgment. And each one of us needs to be ready. But having told that story, Jesus then went on to tell another one, to answer what might be the next question that would come to mind. And that is, okay, we wait. But what do we do while we're waiting? Have you ever had to wait for something? Or for someone? I've taken a few weddings. I think the biggest wait the poor bridegroom had was 40 minutes for the bride to come. And all of us were wondering, and she just lived around the corner. So not quite sure. I never did find out quite what held her up that long. But waiting. It's a problem sometimes, isn't it? I remember one time I was waiting in Seattle Airport to catch a plane to just fly over to Vancouver and then come back through Canada. I'd been in America for a while. And I got there a long while before the plane was due to go. I had to wait. And I filled the waiting with dozing and missed the flight. So that's what can happen. We need to know what to do while we're waiting, don't we? To make it, effective and to bring us to the points that we need to come to. So this is a story, really, about what to do while we're waiting. And let's just read it. It's in Matthew chapter 25 and verse 14 down to verse 30. Matthew 25, verse 14. And this is leading directly on from the other parable, which had started, this is what the kingdom of heaven is like. And so when Jesus says again, he's basically saying, this is also what the kingdom of heaven is like. And he says, again, it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted his property to them. To one, he gave 5 talents of money. It's probably worth pausing just now, because in English today, when we say talent, we mean a sort of natural ability. But this word talent was a more specific word, which meant a weight. It was just a certain amount of something. It was like a pound or a ton or something like that, a talent. And we don't know whether it was a talent that he gave talents of gold or talents of silver or talents of bronze or something. So we don't know quite how much money these servants were given. But it was almost certainly a large amount, certainly in the thousands, if not the tens of thousands, that these people were given. So that's just, we've got to get out of the mind of a talent being an ability. This is talking about money here. So to one he gave 5 talents of money, to another 2 talents, and to another one, 1 talent, each according to his ability. Then he went on his journey. The man who had received the 5 talents went at once and put his money to work and gained 5 more. So also, the one with the 2 talents gained 2 more. But the man who had received the 1 talent went off, dug a hole in the ground, and hid his master's money. After a long time, the master of those servants returned and settled accounts with them. The man who had received the 5 talents brought the other 5. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 5 talents, and see, I've gained 5 more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. The man with the 2 talents also came. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 2 talents. See, I've gained 2 more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. Then the man who had received the 1 talent came. Master, he said, I knew that you're a hard man, harvesting where you haven't sown, gathering where you haven't scattered seed. So I was afraid, and I went out and hid your talent in the ground. See, here is what belongs to you. His master replied, you wicked, lazy servant. So, you knew that I harvest where I haven't sown and gather where I haven't scattered seed? Well then, you should have put my money on deposit with the bankers so that when I returned I would have received it back with interest. Take the talent from him and give it to the one who has the 10 talents. For everyone who has will be given more and he will have an abundance. However, whoever does not have, even what he has will be taken from him. And throw that worthless servant outside into the darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So it's a story. It's a story of how 3 men deal with a long wait. And it's a story which gives us, first of all, 2 positive examples. A key phrase in understanding exactly what was going on, I think, is verse 15. Because in verse 15, we're told right at the end that the master gave to them each according to his ability. It's really important to note that phrase. He obviously looked at his servants and thought, how much can I entrust them with? What is a fair amount to give them? Some people, if you give them a massive amount, they just couldn't cope with it. That wouldn't be fair. How can I apportion it in a way which is fair? And the first servant, he sounds like the one who would have been voted in class most likely to succeed. He was given 5. He had abilities. He had gifts. He had what we would call talents. And when tested with this vast amount of money, he proved that he was just as his master had thought, well able to deal with the big responsibility he was given. He was able. The second man, I'm really impressed with when I stop and think about him, because I think his most noted quality seems to be humility. So easy, isn't it, when somebody is given something more than us, that our natural response is, why? Why wasn't I given 5? Why did I only get 2? But you don't get any of that coming out of the story at all. It seems like he trusted the fact that his boss knew best. His boss was wise and realized that he had a different ability. He probably wouldn't have been able to cope with 5 of these massive amounts of money. The 2 was just about right for him. He'd been given what he could deal with. And so he went on, like the other man, to make the most of what he had. And actually ended up with the same level of return as the first man. He was doubling what his master had given him. But then comes the third man, and with him we have a negative example, I believe. The master obviously had some questions about this third servant. When he looked at his 3 servants, he thought, yeah, he can probably cope with 5. Let's see how he gets on. Yeah, I think that 1 too would be the fair amount, but I'm really not sure about this third bloke. I think if I just give him 1. And I think those questions he had about this third servant were justified, because he was revealed later to be a disgruntled, bitter, lazy servant. It's said about the other 2, and particularly the one with the 5, that he went out and put his money to work. If you think it's easy to double your money, go and try it this week. It probably means you've got to work hard at it. I don't think it meant that they went and put it on the stock market, which happened to have a boom a few years, and he just was able to take it out again. Probably that meant those 2 first servants had had to work really hard while their master was away to be able to double what they got. But this one puts no hard work in at all. He doesn't work hard to do the best with his boss's resources. He not only failed, but he actually insulted his master by saying, "Here's your money back." And of course, he didn't get his money back, did he, the master? He might have got one talent. It might have been the same weight. But we've all heard about inflation, haven't we? I started work on £1,500 a year. Amazing, isn't it? Can you believe that I got paid that much? £30 a week. And out of that £30 a week, I paid for a flat in northwest London. I paid for my food every week. I ran a car. I had fun as well. I clothed myself. I'm not saying to the treasurer this week, that's all I need, honestly. Because money changes, doesn't it? Over the years, the value of that money has changed entirely. And that same amount wouldn't buy anything like that much. A long time after Jesus said it was that this boss returned. So in real terms, by burying the money, it could be said that he actually stole from his master. He wasn't giving him back what was his. It had devalued. It wasn't a precious stone. It wasn't an ornament. It wasn't an antique that would automatically increase in value. It was just money. So the boss had every justification on his return to say, "You're wicked." And that was even without the surly character assessment that the servant made of him. It's right that the master should say, if that's what you thought I was like, then surely you should have been a bit more careful with my property. If you thought I was such an awful person, you should have at least have just put it in a bank so you could give me back more or less the same value as it had when I gave it to you. This servant was of absolutely no value to his master. He'd failed in every way, and his future was sealed. Verse 30, throw that worthless servant outside. So it's a pretty extreme, but a fairly straightforward story. But what is it meant to teach us? Well, as I said a few moments ago, it gives an extra perspective, I think, on the story we looked at last week. It isn't just that we should be ready when the day of reckoning comes. It's also about how we should occupy ourselves while we wait. Let me remind you, if you haven't read back, we can see at the beginning of chapter 24 that this is part of a long talk that Jesus had with his disciples. Jesus here isn't talking to the masses. He's talking to those who've already said, "We want to follow you." And that's vital to understand, because otherwise we might think that what Jesus is saying here is that we are accepted by Jesus depending on how hard we work here on earth. And it isn't saying that. It's saying, for those of you who are already saying you're following Jesus, this is how you should be waiting. Our relationship with him is revealed by how we live, by how we use the gifts that he has given us. I don't think it's saying anything at all, really, about this concept that each one of us has a gift that we have to discover, and when we've discovered that gift, that's it for life sort of thing. This passage particularly isn't saying anything about that. It suggests that each one of us will receive from God. In fact, some people interpret it as we will receive the Holy Spirit. How do we take the fact that we have got God himself within us? But it's whatever we've received from God, how can we deal with that? What can we do with it? And we're responsible for seeing what we are giving back to God from what he's given to us. And I think the focus isn't so much on the fact that they were given these amounts of money. I think the focus is much more on the men themselves. And so the question I'd like to ask of this story this morning is, why were those first two so different from the third man? How can we make sure that we're more like the first two than we are the third? And I think one thing that is very different about them is that they actually loved their master. They enjoyed being his servants. Their great aim in life was to please him and increase his wealth. So it's really a parable with the challenge, how much do you love God, the God you know is coming back? It's about the importance of motives. Earlier in Matthew, we're told that where our treasure is, there our heart will be also. But the third man, if we look slightly below the surface, we see that he was simply looking out for his own skin, pretty ineffectually as it turned out. And so there's a fundamental message right here for every follower of Jesus, I think. Why do I do what I do? Why do I give what I give? Why do I serve where I do? Look looking at our own lives. What do I do? Well, I might teach Sunday school or Bible class. I might play with the music group. I might sometimes preach. I might pray at the front sometimes. I might welcome on the door. I might help with other things. Why do I do that? Is it for my own prestige? Is it so I look good? Is it for my own satisfaction? Is it so that people come up and say how wonderful I am? Because if that's the case, then we're not really bothered about what glory God gets from it. Am I really the center of my world? Such reasons for serving God, for taking his gifts and using them, will never multiply to his glory or give him more than he gave us, in a sense. It's as if we will say when he returns, here's your gift, just as you gave it to me. I've been using it really nicely, but I'm afraid there's nothing extra for you, God. Earlier in Matthew, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said about praying and fasting, he said, if you do it so everybody else sees it, well, you've received your reward. You should do it so your Heavenly Father sees it. You should do it so that even if nobody says thank you, even if people sort of totally don't honor what you're doing, are you doing it for God? That's all that matters. As followers of Christ, we have the opportunity to multiply whatever we have been entrusted with. And those first two, they invested their treasure because their heart was for the joy of their master. You see that, don't you, in the way that they spoke to him. Look what we've got to give you. You entrusted us with this amount, and now we can give you back more. There's a sense of thrill in their heart. But the third man simply buried the treasure because he couldn't care less about his master. It meant he could spend his time on his own business and pleasure. But there's a further clear challenge from this story as well, I think. Why were the first two so different from the third? And that is because they knew their master. See, what we do with our lives, how we live as those who are followers of Jesus, servants of the master, reflects our understanding of who our master is. Isn't it an amazing speech that that man gives? I knew that you are a hard man, that you're unfair, and so I was frightened. I mean, he shows that he wasn't actually frightened by the very fact that he told his master that's what he thought of him. If you're really frightened of somebody, you don't go up and say, I'm frightened of you. So it shows that deep down he knew the master wasn't actually like that. But it was his excuse for living as he had done. Perhaps he fears his master's harshness, but seems to know nothing about his benevolence. How different it was from the attitude of the other two. You entrusted, and look what we can give back to you. They have an eager joy as they are thrilled to bring pleasure to their master. It's what they've been looking forward to during all the hard work of those long years or decades. Wouldn't have been easy investing that money, as I said earlier. But their knowledge of their master was of one who was good and one who was fair and one they wanted to please. They didn't want anything more than to see that sparkle in his eyes as they said, look what we've got to give you. And he said, yeah, I knew you'd be up to the task. Wonderful. Well done, good and faithful servants. The misuse of God's gifts, wrong actions and motives in using them, ultimately stem because we've got a wrong idea of God. But if we have a right idea of God, when we hear his words, well done, good and faithful servant, that will make up for all the hard work, all the knocks we've had along the way. The fact that we've had to give our whole life and energy to the end of serving him, even if nobody else recognizes it. Because he is God, the God who loves and loves to pour blessing on blessing in our lives. So the question is, what do I think of God? Who is the God that I follow? Because many people think that God is just a tough taskmaster. A God who unreasonably piles demand upon demand. A God who, if we step out of line, immediately will strike us from heaven. What, you didn't do your quiet time today? Right, you're going to have an awful day. I'm going to make sure everything goes wrong for you. Is that the sort of God that we think we have? Some people have that idea of God. Yeah, some followers of him as well, because they've experienced that sort of thing from everybody else all their lives. Their parents ran them down, demanded unacceptable things from them. Their partners have let them down. Their friends in their life have let them down. And so we can end up thinking, well, God's bound to be the same as that. We're working things out the wrong way. We're looking at people and saying, therefore, God must be like that. But that isn't the God who the Bible talks about. It isn't the God who's revealed himself to us in Jesus. In Isaiah, we're told that God is gentle, that Jesus is so gentle that he won't snuff out the wick that's just sort of smoking away. He'll fan it and blow it and care for it. He won't break the reed that's broken in that's bruised in the wind. He'll look after it. Elsewhere he says, doesn't he, I am the shepherd, the good shepherd. I'll look after my sheep. He loves us enough to die for us. That's our God. And he's promised that he will walk with us and strengthen us as we pass through the difficulties of life. And then as our love for him grows and as our longing to obey and please him develops, we can be sure that his heart is to reward us magnificently. Eternal joy for those who live to please him, those who prove themselves worthy of his trust. In the story, the reward is presented as a share in the master's happiness. It's probably another way of saying, come and eat with me this evening. We're having a great banquet to celebrate my return. You can be part of it. A bit like we have in that psalm where God said he was like a shepherd. The Lord is my shepherd. And then it says at the end, you prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. And that follows just after it said, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. Life can be tough, but God will honor us in the end. We will be caught up into his glory. Notice it doesn't say, serve Jesus well here and you'll be rich now. It's talking about the day when he comes back. And when he does come back, what he's saying is, live for me now and then you will share my wonderful glory and the perfect environment that I'm preparing for when I return. What we believe about God affects how we live. That's why it's so important to get to know who God is. To get to know what he's really like. Because if we believe the wrong things about him, we'll never want to truly live for him. We might say, yes, I'm a follower, I try to follow God, but we've got this image of him. We don't live lives of joy, that something we do might bring pleasure to his heart. If we claim to be his followers, then we need to learn from these three servants. To learn to use the gifts, the money, the time, the abilities that he's given us for his glory. To take the grace that he's poured into his life by saying, my spirit will live in you. And say, how can I therefore, in his strength, do things for God that will bring glory to him? To live for his purposes, because he's generous and he's kind and he's loving and he's merciful. His gifts are to be used, you see. They're not to be buried. To be forgotten about, or to be held on to. A few weeks ago, we came across a little statement by a Christian writer who said, God made grapes not to look plump and round, but to be squashed, so that wine flows out of them. Are we grapes that moan when God wants to squash us? Or are we ready to see that he has a better purpose than just lovely things hanging on a tree? He wants others to benefit. If we're grudging about what we have, if we say, oh, God's made me this and I wish I was that, or if we squander what he's made us, what he's given us, and we reveal that we reveal in that actually we're not his followers at all, because we're not living for him. And the serious threat of this passage is that we will then share the fate of all those who have wrong ideas about God, who've made other gods. The third servant might have felt, well, what did I do to deserve this? And the answer is, well, you did everything to deserve it by doing nothing. Those who risk nothing risk everything. We can lose everything by doing nothing. Let's not be those who insult his grace by neglecting the call he's given us to use everything we have for his purpose. If we do that, we show we're not true servants. We must beware of those sins of omission as well as sins of commission. It's not just saying about the things we do wrong. It's saying about the things we don't bother to do because we just buried the gift. everything should be done with an eye on the day of judgment. Will I hear my master say, well done, good and faithful servants? Do I want to hear that? Waiting for the Lord is nothing other than working for the Lord. So are we ready for the return of Jesus when all will be sorted out? If not, then don't hesitate. It says in chapter 24, verse 36, no one knows about that day or hour, not even the angels in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. It's going to come. But you don't get ready by trying to be good or impress God. You get ready by turning to him and making him the love of your life. Saying, I now want to live for him and nothing else. And that happens as we understand that he has done what is necessary to change our hearts from those that naturally rebel and reject him into those who seek to live for him and serve him with all the gifts that he's given us. What has he done? Well, nothing less than suffered and died to bear what we deserve for being those rebels. Because don't we recognize there's something of the third servant in each one of us? Something of the one who really is doing it for our ends. Something of the one who really isn't that bothered what God thinks. We're more concerned what other people think. None of us know him as we ought to know him, do we? None of us seek to bring joy to him alone as we ought to. But still he loves us. And still he calls us to know him better. So that we love him better. So that we serve him better. I'd like to just finish with the words of a very old prayer, which I think sums up these truths. It says, day by day, dear Lord, for these three things I pray, to see thee more clearly, to love thee more dearly, and to follow thee more nearly, day by day. To see thee more clearly, to know God better, so that we love him more dearly, as we see who he is, and then we will follow him more nearly, live for him, use our gifts for him. And this is something we need to do day by day.